Hi, everybody. My name's Mickey. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be with you tonight. I get very emotional about Alcoholics Anonymous. How can you not get emotional about something that's given you your life back? And I'm here to share with you whatever God wants me to say about that. First of all, I want to acknowledge a couple of people. I want to acknowledge Pete Kay, because Pete's a good friend of mine. And it was a jaw-dropping moment to find out that Pete got deported. And, you know, my heart goes out to him, and I know that the folks in Vancouver are in for a real treat. And it was through Pete's good offices that I'm with you tonight. And I want to thank Troy. Troy has been fabulous. He picked me up at the airport yesterday, and he has hosted me around town, and what a beautiful city, and what nice people, and it's really been a great experience. And I, it's been a gift from God, because I needed to shift gears. I needed to stop, and I'm telling you, it's hard for me to stop. I don't know if any of you can relate to that. So it's been very, very nice, and the weather's good, because I left 2 days of blizzard in Denver and got on an airplane to come out here, and I didn't know what your weather was going to be like. I was hoping it was going to be better than that. And what a weird spring this has been. And so what I'm here to share with you is a lot of my life. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for 2 weeks of sobriety. I'm not kidding. I thought if I could get 2 weeks where I wasn't that sick anymore, where I didn't hurt like that, I'd be very grateful to you, and I would go back out and drink. And I didn't say that because I was thirsty. There was nothing in a bottle of alcohol or a glass of alcohol I wanted anymore, ever again in my life. But I'd been drinking since I was 4 years old. And I was 27, and I got on that train when I was 4, and I knew I had to ride it to the end of the line. There was no way on this big blue marble that I was ever going to stop drinking. So if I could get my 2 weeks, I could at least be healthy for just a moment and get back on the train. And that was 35 years ago. And I've never had to get back on the train. Now, 35 years isn't the longest anybody's been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I will guarantee you it's the longest I've ever been sober. And what it means is that from the time I was 27 years old until now when I'm 62 years old, I've gotten a shot. I've gotten a shot to find out who it is that God made when he made Mickey. Because, like, in the beginning, God made Mickey. Then Mickey made Mickey, right? And now what's happening in Alcoholics Anonymous through the step work is I've gotten a chance to get closer to the Mickey that God made. I read in another book that we wrap ourselves with the bandages of ego like a mummy, and then we identify with the bandages, and we say, that's me. And we're afraid if those bandages of ego are ever taken off of us, there will be no us. But that's what being poisoned by self means. It means it's all about me, it's all about what I make, it's about what I do, and this is what it means to be playing God. And so when the bandages of ego are stripped off, as they are stripped off, no punishment. There are no punishing steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is really important. Sometimes we are presented with people who are what I would call orthodox in step work. That is, for me, it means that we try, please underline try, to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous by the instructions in the big book. And so now that's a big book thumper, and that has all this other gravity that gets built around it. And apparently, if you're going to talk to somebody about the instructions in the big book, then you've got to be a mean person. you've got to hurt somebody's feelings. Do you know what I mean? We're going to go from being powerless to powerful, and we're going to now impose this program on somebody like they just went to the penitentiary. I don't believe in that. There's too much beauty and grace in here. There's too much kindness. But in working these steps, what's happened is I'd been running. Oh, man. The gratitude hits me so hard. I'd been running all my life. I was kicked out of every school I went to until I got to high school. And I was kicked out because it says in the big book that we alcoholics are an undisciplined lot. And man, I was undisciplined, okay? But it's really important, and I want to present this, because what happens is that I've found in the big book that they're not lying to us. There's all this gold that we're being given. There are two books, and I hope I remember to share the second one with you, that I haven't read, but that the title has meant so much to me. And I'll tell you about one of them right now. It's a book out of the 1950s, and the title of the book is What Makes Sammy Run? What Makes Sammy Run? And I was driven and hounded and beaten down a road, and I didn't know why. I didn't know why I couldn't sit in the school chair. I didn't know why I couldn't sit in class. I didn't know why I wanted to be an altar boy and a vandal at the same time. I was a better vandal. I found this box of report cards from the time I was a little boy, like second and third grade. And there were all these A's. This is important for me. There were all these A's on my report cards. And then if you flip the report card over, you got all this stuff about Mickey. He's a disruptive influence. He's antisocial. Blah, you know, he won't show up for school, and. So what does that tell us, and what does it tell me? It tells me there's nothing wrong with my mind. There's nothing wrong with my mind, but there's something wrong with my spirit, my soul. I heard one time that the mind makes a great servant but a lousy master. So what happens is I tried to use my mind to tame my spirit. How many people have had success with that one? I'd like a show of hands. The truth of the matter is, there's no place on earth I'd rather be right now than right here. This is the most important thing that ever happened to me, what I'm sharing with you. Because I'm paying dues behind all this, you understand? I'm paying dues. I'm out there getting that look. You ever get that look where people look at you and like, who the hell are you? What did you just say? What did you just do? And that was where I was living. Now, I was not brilliant when I played hooky from school, and I played hooky from school a lot. I was like gone, okay? I went one time and sat in a tree for 10 days. I didn't have any place to go. I just didn't want to be in school. You know what I'm saying? I just didn't want to be in any disciplined environment. I didn't want to be any place where somebody would tell me what to do. Because if they told me what to do, I just went Aussie inside. This is not a great way to live. I would be in a classroom, and if the teacher said something that I didn't like, I would stand up in the classroom and tell the teacher what I thought of them. Which you may want to do like once in your fantasy. But I lived that way. I'll give you an idea of who I was, because I'm here to share with you who I was, what happened, and who I is now. This would be a typical, okay, this had a little more grandiosity to it, but all of the motivations that led to what I'm about to tell you were in me all the time. I grew up in Europe. The reason I started drinking at 4 years old was because I grew up in Europe. And in Europe, they give children wine with the evening meal, cut back with water, and aren't we European and ain't I alcoholic? So what happens? When I got sober, I came into AA in 1974. There was a chart on the wall. They don't have it anymore in most places. I don't know if they have Dr. Jelinek's chart in any place you've ever been in AA. But Dr. Jelinek's chart is a horseshoe open at the top. It goes like this. The idea is we're born, I don't know, maybe in their opinion, normal. I've never been normal in my life. Born normal, and then we start drinking, and then we take the ride down to the bottom of the horseshoe, and if we find help at that point, then we can start going back the other side of the horseshoe. I got on the train at 4 years old and started down the horseshoe. And I would love to tell you, and if I don't make anything else, God bless you, clear out of this whole deal tonight, I would love to blame the insanity in my life on booze. Wouldn't that be convenient? Therefore, if you put the plug in the jug, the sun comes out and the angels sing and you're fine. That is not my experience. So anyway, so I'm in the eighth grade. I went to all Catholic schools. I'm in Cathedral Grade School in Rapid City, South Dakota. My father's building missile silos up through South Dakota. And I'm in Cathedral Grade School. I was raised in Europe. And when I went to the flea market in Paris as a little boy, see, like the Germans lost the war. They have no use for their uniforms now. So it looked like Fifth Avenue in New York. You know those garment racks with all the clothes on them? There were garment racks as far as you could see full of German uniforms. And I've always had a huge sense of history. Some people are interested in it. I happen to be one of them. And all these German uniforms, all their decorations, all their swords, boots, helmets, everything were for sale. So I got my little collection of Nazi memorabilia. I bring it back. You know, we're getting closer to the eighth grade in Rapid City, South Dakota. It's show and tell. Everybody wants to bring whatever. I don't know if they want to bring their bug collection or what they're going to bring. And I am about to show up with all the Nazi memorabilia in a Catholic grade school. Oh, yeah. Now, they weren't having that. That's not going to happen. So nurses used to have these white shoes. They wore uniforms with caps and all of that. And so they had these white leather shoes. And to polish their shoes, they had a liquid white shoe polish in a bottle with a white cotton end on it. And what they could do is just put that on their shoes and go off to work, and they were good, right? I got the white shoe polish and got up on the school and put swastikas this big in every window of Cathedral Grade School in Rapid City, South Dakota. On Monday morning, that was on a Saturday night, on Monday morning I showed up and the teacher, sister whatever, is now like calling my best friend who was my henchman in this crime out into the hall. I know it's about this, right? Because we know so much, don't we? And I forgot to tell you that I was new kid in town, and they voted me the class president. So I am the class president, which I thought was I was entitled to. Anyway, so he doesn't come back, and she calls me out. I said, well, this is obvious. We've been caught. And I get out there in the hall. I don't let her talk. We don't want to do that. And I said, I didn't do it. She says, you didn't do what? I said, I didn't put the... And that was it. I was kicked out of one more school. I went home from that day and raided my folks' liquor cabinet and drank a bottle of creme de menthe, which is really gross. But it had alcohol in it, and who cares? And I'm out. So, and they graduated the kids from the eighth grade then, and I stood across the street in a vinyl motorcycle jacket, smoking old gold cigarettes and drinking grain belt beer, into hell with you. And that's the way that's who I was. Not all of me, part of me, was really hungry for God. You know, they tell the story in the big book of Bill being at Winchester Cathedral, I believe, and he walked into Winchester Cathedral and he had a spiritual experience and he knew there was a God. And I remember walking into the cathedral in Rapid City by myself, and I walked up in front of the altar and I knew there was a God. And I just knew it and I felt him. And then I walked back to the door and got back on the train. This disease is a killer. This disease is a killer. It doesn't matter what my finest sense of life is. It doesn't matter how much love I have. It doesn't matter what I want that's really beautiful. That can go away as long as I can live unconscious. And that was my experience. And incidentally, that year was the year that I finally, in the first time of my life, ever found somebody I could identify with. I found a book. It was a biography of Napoleon. And I read that book, and there was this little Corsican kid. And he looked at the world and he said, "I think I'll have it." And you know, he did a pretty good job, or a pretty bad job, depending on what you think of Napoleon. The guy was brilliant. He was brilliant. He was also insane. And I thought, that's me. I'm brilliant. I'm just going to blossom, and it's all going to come out just like Napoleon Bonaparte, and it'll all be good. It didn't work out that way. So I had a nun help me through high school. She was a senior English teacher, and she saw me coming for 3 years. And she called me into her classroom before school started on my senior year. And she wasn't, there was something different about her. She was not afraid of me. And it impressed me so much. And she called me into the classroom, and then she did something that impressed me also. She asked me a question. She said, "Mickey, what do other people think of you? Not what do you think of them, but what do they think of you?" And it was the first time in my life ever that I could recall somebody asking me to be objective. And I don't remember what I answered her. But I was so impressed that she wasn't afraid of me and that she'd asked me a question I absolutely couldn't answer. And I went into her classroom, and anything that I came up with as a thought, which were really screwy thoughts, I got to tell you, she'd say, "Do a paper on it." And then I would come and present the paper to the class. I don't know what the hell my classmates thought about these papers. But I loved that woman, and she helped me graduate from high school. And I went around the country for over 20 years telling people how much I loved her. And it occurred to me that I had never told her. So I found her, and I went and sat across the desk from her, and I told her what she meant to me. You know, because when you have this disease, you are an endangered species. This disease wipes us out from the family of man and woman. It wipes us away from our jobs, from our families, from ourselves. It's a serious, serious disease. Now, here's the kicker. You know, we know that nobody speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous, right? We're all here to share our own experience, strength, and whatever understanding we have of this thing. So I'm going to share something with you that is an opinion. I just wanted to flag it. You don't have to agree with it, but I'd like you to consider it for a moment. Alcohol is a non-addictive substance. Alcohol is a non-addictive substance. How do we know that? Like, mother-in-law statistics, roughly 9 out of 10 people on planet Earth can drink alcohol with more or less impunity. But 1 out of 10 people are absolutely allergic to that substance. Absolutely addictive around alcohol. So, and my conclusion, incidentally, is that alcohol is non-addictive. The addiction is in me. Alcohol's not the enemy. Alcoholism is the enemy. I'm not saying alcohol won't kill me, because it will. I get hold of that. I'll give you an example. I was 10 years sober. I'd never heard of non-alcoholic beer. And I went to a job interview, and I was like, it was for an important job. I'm 37 years old, and I want to look like a big kid in the interview. And I look on the menu, and it says Moosey, alcohol-free beer. This is before we had the information on it. I'm saying it's alcohol-free. I love beer. That's what I drank mostly until it got late, and I drink whatever you had. But so I order the beer, and they bring it out, and I'm having my Moosey beer. And I'm looking like a big kid because I really wanted to impress this lady who was interviewing me for this job. And I'm drinking this beer, and I'm watching her come in and out of focus. And I'm going, no, this is a hysterical reaction. I haven't had a beer in me for 10 years. What are we talking about? And my wife has been in Al-Anon for 35 years. She's non-alcoholic. I get two of these things. I go back to her. I call her. I said, listen, something's wrong. I think I just had a hysterical reaction because it says it's alcohol-free. I take it back with her. I drink it. I'm feeling it again. And I look at her face, and she's like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which is what happens when she consumes alcohol. Less than one half of 1% alcohol. And inside of me, I say, I'd like to get a case of that stuff. So I'm not telling you that that alcohol is safe in any way for me. I'm telling you that the disease exists in me and not in the bottle. Otherwise, I would really love it if somebody would tell me, how much alcohol do you have to drink to catch this disease? Whatever. Now, is alcohol the problem in our lives? If someone were to ask you, why do you work steps? Would your answer be, I work steps so that I can stay sober, get and stay sober? That would be a legitimate answer. That would be a legitimate answer. I will tell you that I work steps so that the defects in my character do not issue an invitation to alcohol to enter my body, because that bottle ain't coming off that shelf and pouring itself into my mouth. It is through the disease of alcoholism that I will extend that invitation to that bottle. If you're going to dry me out, you got to help me out. Because what happened is I got sober and I ran into the Mickey those teachers had tried to be with all those years, and I couldn't control him either. Couldn't control money. Sex was an unbelievably difficult issue for me. Ego. I was so angry nobody would even get close to me. What's all that? And the big book says our liquor was but a symptom. It's a symptom of the disease of alcoholism. What are some of the other symptoms? Well, we go to page 52. We're a prey to misery and depression. We can't make a living. We're full of fear. We're driven by 100 forms of, and it goes on like that. And then it says this thing, was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. When we saw others solve their, and watch this, please. This is the most, I'm going to tell you the most important plural word I ever read in my life. When we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. Now we're cooking. I don't know how to live sober. Do you? If you take away alcohol out of your life and you don't have meetings and you don't have any help and you don't have any higher power, do you know how to live? I certainly don't. As a matter of fact, I'll look for substitutes for the booze. That's where the sex came in. 6 years of pornography. It just made me feel horrible. And I'm carrying this secret, and it's like I'm a creep. And I'm sober. I'm supposed to be a winner. And I'm married. And I'm like addicted to this thing. Because why? Because the bottle's gone. I begged God for 6 years 6 years, please take this away from me. And after 6 years, he did. And I got to live clean. And I'm telling you something. For the women in the room, that may not mean anything to you, this kind of an addiction. But I'll guarantee you, for the men in this room, I've seen a lot of heads nodding. To be consumed and eaten alive by self is horrible, whether you're drunk or whether you're sober. So what I'm looking for in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a song, and a lyric in the song said, "My old man was a man like Lincoln." And I aspired to that. I wanted to be a good man. And I heard this guy one time from a podium say, "Well, hell, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to become a Boy Scout." And I'm sitting there thinking, well, I did. I just want to live clean. I want to be a man you can trust, and I want to be a man I can trust. And the only way to do that is to have God tame me. I used to have these mottos once a year. I would have a motto of the year. I have no idea why. And one of my mottos one year is, "God, please tame me." Because when you are dry and you are crazy and you are compulsive, it's really not very much fun being alive. I'll tell you what I mean. I had a loaded .32 automatic pistol in my drawer. My wife knew it for the first 3.5 years of my sobriety. I did not enjoy being sober. I don't know if anybody else can relate to that. I didn't enjoy being sober. I used to come home from a meeting. My wife would be in bed. I would go and lay in on the living room floor in the dark, and I would beg God to kill me because I couldn't stand being sober. And I had this gun, and I had this plan, okay? Now, if you were to ask anybody who's new in here or anywhere, or maybe not new, if you have a plan, I guarantee you, you do. I will guarantee you, you have a plan. Usually it really stinks too. My plan was that if this doesn't work, I'm putting my brains on the wall. Good plan, huh? We have this ace and we keep it up our sleeve. And we may know we have it and we may not know we have it. And the idea is, if I get backed into a corner, I'm playing my ace. That was my ace. Now, the F-4 Phantom attack aircraft has two people in it. There's the pilot, and everybody writes the books about the pilot. And it's warranted because the pilot does a great job. And flying in combat is not an easy assignment. But to me, the hero is the backseater, which is called a Rio or a Wizzo, and he operates the instruments and does a lot of work in that, electronic work in that aircraft. But think about it. That pilot is going into combat. That aircraft is going where the pilot says it's going. But that rear seater gets no vote. And that was my wife. She could have left, but she was pretty much going where I was going. And she was my hero. And I would go off to work that day. And if she came home later than me, she didn't know if she was going to come home and find me dead on the floor. My wife and I have been married for 38 years. I'm with the lady I brung. And I'm really glad. It was one of my aspirations was to be married, and I didn't know how to do it. And through the work in this program, I've gotten a chance to be married to my wife all of these years, and I really love her. And none of what I've told you about the pornography or any of that stuff was hidden from her. It was initially, but finally it was choking me to death. And we worked through it together. Wouldn't it be lovely if we could just focus all of our meetings on drinking? It's really easy, isn't it? I drank so hard, and we make it this spitting contest. I drank harder than you did. I spilled more on my tie than you ever, you know what I mean? And it would go like this. And some guy that's wrapped, you know, peeled himself off of a steam pipe downtown somewhere and come in here, we make him the president of AA because he had more alcohol than we ever saw in our combined lives. And I'm not saying the man didn't suffer, but I don't think that's the standard that we need to look up to. I think the standard we need to look up to is, have you taken on the toughest opponent you will ever meet in your life? And that's yourself. And what have you done with it? And what can we share together? How many of us are sitting, and I'll tell you something, we talk about the newcomer so much, and it's appropriate. But here's somebody sitting in your meeting, and they're 23 years sober, and they're so lonely, they can't stand it. And they're having trouble with their jobs, and they're 23 years sober, and they're afraid to tell anybody because you can't scare the newcomer away. So let me tell you what happened to me. You know, we owe each other the truth in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if what I'm saying has value in your life or not, but I'll promise you I need to say it. 23 years sober, I would have told you that I was not attached to money. I had a hotel that we lived in. I collected antique cars. I had the swimming pool. I had an 8-bedroom home. I had my own advertising agency. I lost it all. And when it started to go, I would have told you, I'm not connected to material. Come on. You know, I'm spiritual. Dude, I'm 23 years sober. I had an affair. Because I found out something that's more attractive than sex, and it is worship. When somebody looks at you like you are it, it is a very interesting drug, and I damn near died behind it. So I met her, but I never slept with her. It was not a sexual affair. It was an affair of the heart, but it almost killed me anyway. So I lost everything. I'm sitting down in... I've got an office that somebody gave me. I'm not paying any rent on it. I've got a telephone that never rings, and I'm sitting here going through this, and I'm 23 years sober, but I'm a winner. You know what I'm saying? I was so scared, and I had no sponsor. Oh, let's throw that in. Hadn't had a sponsor for a long time. Okay? But I have peers, you know, me and my fellow wizards will, you know, I'll tell them a little bit and we'll do, you know, what, you know what I'm saying? Can, you know, and the ego is like, it was really a pretty slick office I had. It had AstroTurf on the floor and it was down in a lower part of town and here we are, okay? And one night I couldn't take it anymore and I went to play the ace. And I got out of my chair onto the floor, and I couldn't move, and I was just paralyzed down there. And I could see the telephone up there, and I could see the sun setting through the window, but I did not call my wife. She had no idea where I was, and she had no idea that I was about to take my life. And if you want to define hell as the absence of God, I went to hell. There's no way I can communicate to you how black and dark and awful and without hope that place is. And I would lay it on that floor for 4 hours, and every 5 minutes, it's, am I going to open the veins in my wrist now or 5 minutes from now? And I went through that for 4 hours. And I couldn't do it, which I'm eternally grateful for, of course. But I couldn't take my life. I kept thinking about how cold it was going to be because I couldn't take my life there on that floor. I'd make a mess. And out the back door was dirt, so I knew that the dirt would swallow up the blood. And I knew that it was cold out there, and I'd be cold, and I'd be colder when the shock hit as I started to lose my blood, my lifeblood. And I couldn't do it, and I fell asleep. And during the worst part of all this, when I had lost, I used to tell people, I don't have anything, but at least I have my integrity. And then I lost my integrity through this affair. And I used to ask God, I would say two things to God during the worst of that time. I would say, God, I can't breathe. And I would say, please, can I have a cookie? I just meant something, you know, can I just have something, a cookie, out of this blackness that incidentally, in case anybody's keeping score, I put myself into that blackness, okay? Can I have a cookie? And the next morning I woke up and I called somebody that I had met in Minnesota. And they knew somebody that was in St. Paul, Bob B., who's going to be at Fellowship of the Spirit in Utah here, from St. Paul. And she, you know, said he was really a great guy. And she had her big book out, and she was reading me things. And the more I listened to her, the less I was interested in talking to Bob. And I asked her on the spot if she would be my sponsor. And her name is Cookie. Didn't occur to me at the time, but God gave me a cookie. And she stayed with me for 4 years, and she talked me back into life. And I wanted to instantly, I was 23 years without a drink, and I wanted to really be able to rock and roll, you know, I'm back, you know. And she kept saying to me, Mickey, you don't have the spiritual muscle for what you're trying to pull off. You've got to grow. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous 101. And I had been making six figures. And I started painting apartments by the grace of God for $7 an hour. And I would ride my bicycle over there. And I painted the apartments. And then I got a temp job, and I was making $7.50. And then I was making $8.75. And I didn't know if I could be an employee because I'd been an advertising typhoon, you know. And I was a big deal, and now can I be even an employee? Can somebody tell me to do something, and I'll do it? And I found out I could, and I was offered a job at every temp job I ever went to. And it meant something to me that they wanted to hire me. I didn't take those jobs, and I kept doing temporary work. I worked up to 11 and a half an hour. And I had a lot of different jobs. One of the jobs I had, I was in an aftermarket auto parts company, and I bought $1.25 million worth of headlights every month. And I was proud. I was proud that I did my job, I did the best I could, and I went in and did a day's work for a day's wages. The training is fierce in here, have you noticed? And the idea and the notion that we have to have all the answers at 8 years sober or 5 years sober or 3 years sober has to be dispelled. We don't have to have all the answers ever, ever. What we have to have is a willingness to do the dance, to work our program out of the book. I've been given the gift of desperation. Now, obviously, I need it. But I'm 35 years sober. And I have what you have. You know what I'm saying? I have exactly what you have. What you wake up with in the morning, I wake up with in the morning. If I don't work my program, there's a knife waiting for me. And incidentally, somebody told me I had to throw my ace away. To throw my ace away. Which means that no matter what happens in my life, I will stand my ground with God. I will try to. Okay? No matter what happens. So my sponsor at one point says to me, one day he said, Mickey, I see that you're an $11.50 an hour man. Now there's nothing wrong with $11.50 an hour, and there's nothing wrong with being a janitor. There's nothing wrong with any of that. But I have a college degree, and at one point, anyway, I have a contribution to make. But I didn't know what because I'm getting older, you know? And trying to get back in advertising is a young man's game. And I was dead man walking. I was a dinosaur. And I didn't know what to do. The big book says, we are in this world to play the role he assigns, okay? So the notion behind that is, God did not get me sober for my reasons. He got me sober for His reasons. My life belongs to Him. I'm here to do what He wants me to do. I wanted to be an artist all my life, but an artist is, for me, somebody who's up there, way up there. An artist is like this magic person, and they're special. So I never could be an artist, you know, because, man, I mean, you know, here's my life, right? So I'll tell you this story. So our son, and then I want to tell you about the kids, and I know my time is running low. And I have to tell you, it's already started happening to me. I'm hanging on to you. I just love you. And I love being with you. Anyway, so our son came back from his graduate school, which I'll tell you about. And we were bored, and in our family, we're never bored. And so now we're empty nesters, so it's just Marie and I, my wife and I, and our son. And he said, well, my art teacher in college said, if you get bored, you need to conceive of and execute an art project in an hour. So I conceived of this thing in an hour, and I executed it in an hour, and I don't know why I did this, but I made a leather cowboy boot Christmas tree ornament. Then I got to looking at the ornament, and I thought, this looks pretty cool. And what that did is, and I heard people about, they visualized, okay? You know, when you have this thing, and, you know, so I went to the thrift store, and I got children's cowboy boots, and I put them up everywhere. They were at the foot of our bed. They were on our computers. I got children's cowboy boots everywhere. And I'm reminding God, this is about ornaments, right? Because I knew that custom boot makers don't make any money. So I'm like, this is about ornaments, right? So I'm visualizing this thing, and I am a custom cowboy boot maker. That's what I do. It turns out that the art God wanted me to do is on my feet and on other people's feet. And it turns out that I have a real talent for it. And it turns out that I started doing it when I was 56 years old. And everybody knows at 56 years old, you're almost dead. And I thought that. I'm too old to take on something new like this, whatever. And I was studying with this master. He'd been making, at that time, custom cowboy boots for 54 years. And I asked him, I said, Hutch, how many people have you taught to make cowboy boots? And he does it one at a time. And he said, oh, about 40. He says, I said, Hutch, well, he said, I've taught about 40 people to make boots, and he looked at me and he said, Mickey, you're the best student I ever had. No, I'm not bragging, I'm just telling you that I came by this through the darkest road, through the most convoluted path, and that He will lead us sometimes in ways that are not level and smooth, huh? And we think that it's all over, and we think we'll never have a chance. And at the same time, about a year before that, my son, okay, I'll tell you right now that we have three kids. Our daughter is 38 years old, and she is an alcoholic, and she's a sober alcoholic. And she's a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's a beautiful woman, and I'd put my life in her hands any day. She and I were the ones who really butted heads, and we have so much love between us, it's just fabulous. And while I have the time, I'll tell you that in the course of things, I used to sponsor, and I had this whole, at one time, I had this raft of all these young single men. And eventually we would get down to talking about women and about dating and about the purpose of dating. And I would say to them, I wonder where the woman that God has for you is tonight. I wonder what she's doing and who she is. And unbeknownst to me, for this one particular guy, she was upstairs because he fell in love with my daughter. But I didn't know that, see, and I heard his fifth step first. Then I found out and I stopped sponsoring. You'll be happy to know. And they're both sober and they're both members in good standing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on the Monday after Easter, my daughter gave birth to her sixth child. She has four boys and two little girls. And she's a great mom. She's a great mom. And I have a son who lives in Buffalo, New York, and he's married and has two daughters, and he's a real man. He's one of the gentlest, kindest men I ever met in my life. But he married a woman going in, he knew this, with multiple personality disorder. And in the time, we had only one prayer for Neil. We used to pray, here was our prayer for Neil. God, please give Neil a woman who just loves him something terrible. And he got a woman who loves him something terrible, and she's fully integrated most of the time. But he knew it going in. I just admire him so much. Then came our baby, Peter. And Peter is like the most polite guy you'd ever meet. Nice, pulling D's and F's in school. He turned into Mr. Hempo for a long time. And we did not know it. And just so nice. And I couldn't figure out. And a vocabulary like you can't believe. And this is in grade school. And I'm going, what is wrong with this kid? And of course, I'm giving him the speech, you know, and whatever. And then I walked. This is God will take care of us. God will take care of us. I walked into the public library looking for a book to read. And you know how they put the new books up on top of some of the lower shelves sometime? And I looked at this book, and the title of the book is They Can, But They Don't. And it showed a little boy sitting at his desk in school. And it turns out this book was written by a PhD in education and who had identified a learning disability that my son has. And I was able to go home and say, Peter, it's going to be okay. And he went on to get a master's degree, and our son Peter today is a Roman Catholic priest. And I call him a baby priest. He's been a priest for 3 years, and he's really a good priest, and he's really a good man. And when people go into confession to Peter, I've heard this from other people, that he will say, if you're having problems, why don't you go to Al-Anon? Why don't you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? And Peter called me last week, and he said, Dad, and he doesn't go to Al-Anon, but I'm hoping he will. And he said, Dad, would you show me how to write inventory? He said, because I work with people and there's nothing like the fourth step for really getting to the problem. And he said, I'd like to know it for me and I'd like to have it for them. And I said, Peter, I'd be honored. I came from a family, there was so much violence. It was horrible. I was the baby in my family. And I got into AA and I couldn't figure out why I couldn't fall asleep. I couldn't fall asleep. I had to make a decision to go to sleep. And that went on and on and on. And then I remembered what it was like if you fell asleep in my house. You fell asleep in my house, and the war would go on in the next room, and it was horrible. I went in at 12 years old and saw my father strangling my mother on her knees, and she's screaming to call the police. That's the way I grew up. And I wanted this thing I wanted to break the cycle of violence. My wish to God when I would pray, please, God, when my children's head hit their pillows, can they get 8 hours of peace? And they got that. Not perfect in our house, not perfect, please. But we worked together for that. And our children and I and their mother have a lot of love between us, a lot of real love. I mean, that's what you want in a family, right? So does the program of Alcoholics Anonymous work? Yes. I think it works more effectively if I'll stop making the bottle of booze a straw man, an ogre, something drooling under the bed. And I'm going to work my whole life and my whole program so that I don't drink alcohol. We need to not drink alcohol. I want to be very, very clear about that. But what about the notion of working my program to become who God made me? to play the role he assigns, to come home inside. And I will tell you that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous will do that. There are people who say, God bless, this is just this guy talking, I only do 1/4 step. My sponsor says we only do 1/4 step. I'll tell you what I do. I work the program like a revolving door. 1 through 12, 1 through 12, 1 through 12. I work it formally every year and sometimes 2 and 3 times. They told me it's the only thing, Mickey, that you can't OD on. And I'm sure they meant it. Well, what does it do? Imagine just for a moment, just in your imagination, what it would be like for me to have stayed sober on the inventory I took 35 years ago. Is it possible I've changed since then? We talk about peeling the onion. Well, what about writing an inventory from this layer of the onion? What are we going to discover? And I'll tell you what happens to me is that I don't discover stuff, oh yeah, in the last year I really, you know, didn't play enough or whatever, which incidentally is a problem for me. But anyway, I will find out things that I've had in me since I was a child and I wasn't ready to see yet. I'll give you an example. When I was 6 years sober, I was watching a program on television on rape. And I found myself, I pulled 1 foot off the floor, and then I pulled the other foot up off the floor, and I remembered that I was sexually molested when I was 8 years old. And I buried it so deep that I didn't even remember it anymore. And now I got both my feet up on the couch and I'm coming unglued inside. And I remembered, I never told anybody. I never told my parents. I lived with that. And it does things to you. You lose your innocence. And I became predatory in sexuality. And I never, ever, ever knew that there was a connection. I thought I was just a creep. And so you see the blessings. If we keep working the program, we're peeling the onion. We're finding out about ourselves. Okay, last commercial. The 10th step. You ever want to have a really short meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous in a discussion group? Throw the 10th step out there. And I'm sure it's different here. But anyway, I promise I'm going to shut up in just a minute. Okay, 1 minute. All right, so the 10th step. Read what the 10th step says, the Tai Chi, the directions in the big book. And here's a guarantee. I guarantee I will make you. If you will do the 10th step on a daily basis with someone else, it will revolutionize your whole life. Read the directions. We continue to watch for fear, dishonesty, selfishness, and resentment. When these crop up, not if, we ask God at once to remove them, then this is the thing, the reason we don't do it. We discuss it with someone immediately. We make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone, and then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone else we can help. If you do that on a daily basis, it will revolutionize your life. I guarantee it. I love you very much. Thank you so much for the invitation to be with you.
Thank you very much.